The Permanent Remedy, Insight Knowledge, page 42. It is only insight knowledge, vipassana, that enables us to overcome the defilements once and forever. As the yogi watches the sense objects, such as the sight, sound, etc., attentively, he finds them, as well as the consciousness, passing away constantly. There is nothing permanent to be found. No impression of visual objects or sound is left on his mind. He is not defiled by greed or ill will in connection with his seeing or hearing, nor does the recollection of any event lead to defilement, since the pleasantness or unpleasantness of the sense object is not apparent at the moment of seeing or hearing. And the insight into the impermanence of every object and the cognizing consciousness leaves no room for unwholesome propensities. Watchfulness is essential, for the yogi cannot overcome the defilements stemming from sense objects that escape his attention. Constant watchfulness and the subsequent perfection of insight knowledge lead to contact with Nibbana on the path of the Aryas. Such an illumination roots out the respective defilements. At the Sotapatti stage, ego belief and doubt become extinct. The yogi no longer commits evil, such as killing, stealing, etc., that tends to land him in the lower worlds. True, he is not yet wholly free from greed and ill will. He still craves for pleasant objects, and he still takes offense at anything that displeases him. But his greed and ill will are not base and pernicious enough to make him kill or steal. A true Sotapanna is wholly free from evils that lead to the lower worlds. This is then the way to conquer defilements through insight knowledge. The Sareka practice calls for such total conquest. Some yogis become complacent when they are absorbed in jhana. Concentration on the in and out breathing or any other object often results in the rigidity of the whole body and total oblivion. To the instructor and to those around the yogi, this state of consciousness may mean absorption in jhana. But in the absence of insight knowledge of nama and rupa, the distinction between them and their anicca, dukkha, anatta, such a state may indicate nothing more than deep concentration. Later on, the yogi may have serious moral lapses and betray his true character. This is because concentration by itself cannot stamp out defilements. For their total extinction, we need insight knowledge that leads to contact with Nibbana. Total extinction of defilements is assured only when we find that we are not capable of, say, killing under any circumstances. If we are capable of killing under extenuating circumstances, it is safe to assume that our Sareka practice is imperfect. The act of killing. We will now consider the constituent factors of the act of killing from the standpoint of Buddhist ethics. There are essential factors. 1. The object must be a living being. 2. There must be the awareness of it being a living being. 3. The doer must have the intent to kill. 4. There must be the effort to kill or to cause death, such as striking, cutting, etc. 5. This effort must result in the destruction of life. If any of these factors is lacking, it cannot be strictly called an act of killing. The destruction of grass or plants that are mistaken for living beings does not constitute an act of killing. It is, of course, unwholesome because it is motivated by ill will, but it will produce no evil karmic effect worth speaking. Nor is the destruction of a living being, which you mistake for an inanimate object, an act of killing, since there is no intent to kill. No less karmically sterile is your act that results accidentally in the death of a living being, for it is an involuntary act. For example, when a morally scrupulous man is bitten by an ant, he will have to remove it. If his act accidentally leads to the death of the insect, it has no karmic effect because it is devoid of the volition of chetana to kill. Suppose the first four conditions are present, but the subject fails to cause the death of his victim. It is morally unwholesome act. Its karmic gravity depending on the life quality of the victim. If the victim dies as a result of your effort, it is an act of killing, pure and simple, but you will have to pay for it according to his place in the universe. If the killer's volition is weak, the karmic effect is little. If it is strong, the effect is great. Again, the magnitude of the karmic effect is determined by the stress and strain involved in the effort to kill, as well as by the moral character of the victim. Causing others to kill, an act of killing has karmic effect, not only when you yourself kill, but also when you incite another person to kill. If you show by signs your desire to cause the death of a living being, that too is an act of killing on your part. This is important and should be borne in mind by housewives. It is said that at the fish stalls in the bazaar, fish are usually kept alive and battered to death only on demand by customers. Buying fish that have already been killed by fishmongers may not produce any karmic effect, but to turn your back at the sight of live fish and buy it later on, after it has been done to death, does not make you karmically less guilty. So you should be mindful when you are out shopping in the bazaar. Meat for bhikkhus. A bhikkhu should avoid eating three kinds of meat: the meat of an animal that he has seen being killed expressly for his meal, the meat of an animal which he understands has been killed for him, and the meat that has raised doubt as to whether the flesh of some of the animal has been intended for him. In some villages where there are no meat vendors, the chicken curry which a layman serves a visiting monk is suspect. Unless he can remove his suspicion, it is not proper for the monk to eat. Eating the three kinds of questionable meat is not a karmic act of killing, but according to the Vinaya rules, it is bad and constitutes a clerical offence. According to the Jains, a man who eats the flesh of an animal which he knows has been killed for his food will have to bear half the karmic consequences of killing. This view is not shared by Buddhists, but to eat knowing that the animal is being killed for you shows lack of compassion and may lead to further acts of killing for you. So it is not proper for a bhikkhu to eat any meat that makes him suspect that the animal has been killed to provide food for him and for another monk or for the Sangha. It is said that the Sinhalese bhikkhus consider it improper to eat eggs. This is reasonable, for when the eggs are to be offered as food, these have to be freshly boiled or fried for them. There is cause for misgiving, even though the bhikkhu sees or hears nothing that makes him suspicious. There are eggs, such as those preserved in salt or lime solution, which one can eat with a clear conscience. The same is true of boiled eggs in the bazaar. Then there are unhatchable eggs, which many people suppose to be lifeless. I, for one, have doubt about this view. The eggs may contain a living being that is destined to die in its embryonic state. For the karmic destiny of some living beings is indeed very strange. Some are conceived in the rocks and crushed, as they were in such a narrow place. They would suffer much, and one wonders what evil karma might have consigned them to this terrible fate. Perhaps there may be such ill-fated living things in the unhatchable eggs. We assume, however, that those who eat eggs, supposing them to be lifeless, are not karmically guilty, because the two essential factors, the sign of life and the will to cause death, are lacking. Public feeding on festive occasions in some villages calls for reflection. There are no meat sellers, and so if people are to be served with meat, order has to be placed in advance for it. Thus, regrettably, the donor, who is out to gain merit by giving alms, has to bear at least in part the karmic responsibility for the slaughter of animals. It also raises the question of whether the bhikkhus should eat the meat curry offered on such occasions. It is said that in some villages, pigs are taken to the monastery to be killed on the eve of the religious festival. This is, of course, downright impropriety, Some 30 years ago, a friend of mine who was residing at a village monastery had to protest vehemently against the practice. Again, we have to consider whether it is proper for the monks to eat dan buk, specially prepared rice with meat, supplied by hotels. Such kind of food is questionable in view of the possibility of some animal having been killed specially for the festive occasion. So the best way to ensure strict conformity with the precept against taking life is to avoid eating meat. If we are not vegetarians, we should be very careful about our food in order to keep ourselves undefiled by any act of killing. The best way to uproot the desire to kill is to watch all phenomena arising from the senses. Those who are not watchful will wish to destroy any being that offends them, but the ever-watchful yogi, who realizes anicca, dukkha and anatta, will not see or hear the offensive object, let alone have the desire to destroy it. In the event of being bitten by an ant, the unmindful and vicious man will kill the insect instantly. The virtuous man suppresses the desire to do so, and so he will remove it. But the watchful yogi will be aware of pain, and he will note it arising and passing away. He will, therefore, have no ill will, much less the desire to kill. If the pain is unbearable, he will attend to it, but never with the desire to kill. Thus his consciousness is invulnerable to unwholesome thoughts, and he is always free from the defilement of killing. Karmic effects. The Buddha points out the karmic effects of killing and non-killing in his reply to Subha's question about the inequality of human beings. There are various causes of this inequality. We may explain it in terms of what we observe in regard to the influence of heredity and environmental factors such as food, etc. But even some identical twins do not have the same span of life, and so observation of life does not by itself dispose of the problems of human differences. We have then to consider two explanations that have nothing to do with empirical data. One presupposes the creator of the world, while the other a law of karma. According to the first view, the world and all human beings were created by God, or what the Hindus call Brahma. The belief and the creator arose long before the rise of Buddhism, and it is mentioned in the Patika Sutta of Digha Nikaya. Those who believe in the creator hold that the brevity or longevity of a man's life is predetermined by his creator. Stillborn babies. But it is difficult to answer the question, why do some babies die shortly after their birth? These ill-fated babies are to be found among all people, irrespective of their religion or irreligion. Notwithstanding all the best doctors and best childcare, civilized societies have to still contend with infant mortality. Many a woman, with her strong maternal instinct, devotes much attention to the care of her child, yet it does not survive for long. On the other hand, some village women have a lot of children, although they do not care much for their offspring. If we are to believe that a baby dies in accordance with the will of God, why is he shortened the life of an innocent human being? Why has he caused the unhappiness of the child's parents who have faithfully worshipped him? The Buddha's answer. According to the Buddha, the man or the woman who cruelly kills another living being is liable to land in hell, where he suffers for millions of years. If after release from hell, he is reborn as a human being, his lifetime will be comparatively short. Here the Buddha's discourse suggests only the possibility of the killer's suffering in hell. But every killer is not so condemned on his death. Some killers may be reborn in the human or deva worlds by virtue of their overwhelming good deeds. For example, the high-ranking army officer in Narada Jataka, was a butcher in his previous existence. But they have to pay for their evil karma in due course and suffer in hell for many years. If they are reborn as human beings, they do not live long. If their karma is not good enough to ensure rebirth in the human world, they become animals, their lifespan is short, and they usually die a violent death. Thus, fowls and ducks are killed for human consumption, and so are cattle, pigs, and goats. The animals in the sea survive by eating the weak, but they in turn are eaten up by the more powerful species. The living things with the shortest span of life are the insects that live on cultivated plants. They are usually destroyed for fear of an accurate shortage of food, for fear of an acute shortage of food. This brevity of life in the animal world is, from the Buddhist point of view, largely due to acts of killing in previous existences. In the human world too, some are stillborn, some die immediately after birth, and some die in their childhood or youth. Some die in accidents, some are murdered, and the lives of some people are cut off by terrible diseases. All these premature deaths are due to evil karma associated with killing. There are many stories in the commentaries to show the karmic effect of killing. One is as follows. For killing a sheep, long ago a prince in Benares vowed to the tree deity that when he became king, he would offer the blood of 101 kings and their queens. On his wish being fulfilled, he captured all the kings and queens and set about making preparations for the sacrifice. The queen of the youngest king was called Damodina. She made obeisance to her husband, but not to the king. Then, chided by the latter, she said that she paid respect only to her husband because he was her benefactor. Then she wept and laughed when the king asked her whether she was crazy. She told the story of one of her previous lives. Long ago, in one of her past existences, she was a housewife. One day, while her husband was sleeping, some of his friends came, and she sent her slave girl to buy meat for the guests. But no meat being available, she cut off the head of a ewe at the back of her house and prepared the food for them. For this evil deed, she suffered in hellfire, and because of the karmic debt that still remained, she had been beheaded as many times as there were strands of wool on the body of the ewe. She wept because she was sorry for the king, who would have to suffer like her for his bloody sacrifice. She laughed because she was happy at the thought that the suffering involved in the repayment of her karmic debt was now drawing to a close. The king was shocked. He begged the captives for their forgiveness and released them. Mata Kabata Jataka. This Jataka is the story of a Brahmin who offered animal sacrifice for the welfare of the dead in accordance with the Vedic instructions. Mata Kabata means offering food for the dead. It involved the ritual killing of a sheep, performance of sacrifice, and feasting. For this misdeed, the Brahmin became a ram for 500 lifetimes and got his head chopped off in every life of existence. The Burmese saying about 500 lifetimes of suffering for an evil karma is apparently based on this Jataka. What is then the karmic cause of the grief of the parents over the loss of their short-lived child? This is not hard to understand from the Buddhist point of view. Presumably they were the parents of a killer in a previous existence. Probably they approved of what their son or daughter had done, and hence their unhappiness in the present life. The good karma of non-killing. According to the Buddha, one who avoid killing will enjoy longevity in a future life. This is what he says in Chula Karma Vibhanga Sutta of Majjhima Nikaya. The commentaries on Kuda Kapata and Itivuttaka also mention 32 benefits that accrue to those who avoid killing. Among them are beauty, longevity, health, popularity, services of a good many attendants, freedom from worry, and association with one's beloved. Those who want to be good-looking in a future life should avoid killing. The commentaries mention 8 characteristics of beauty, viz. Absence of deformities, well-proportioned body, shapeliness of the feet, gracefulness, softness of the skin, purity, good features, and good form. By longevity, the commentaries mean living a long life and dying naturally. That is, not to die by the hand of a murderer. Health consists in freedom from disease and endowment with strength and agility. Popularity means being liked by other people and speaking inoffensively. So one who avoids killing will have an unlimited number of attendants. Freedom from worry is another karmic fruit that we can enjoy in a future existence. If we avoid killing, everybody wants to live a carefree life, and hence the popularity of books like How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. The best way to overcome worry is to lead a good moral life and practice the Satipatthana meditation constantly. This way of life, which the yogis at this meditation center follow faithfully, is, as the Buddha says, the only bulwark against grief and anxiety. Still, another good karmic fruit is the non-separation from one's beloved, like wife, children, etc., and from one's much prized possessions. Equally good is the karmic fruit in the form of having a good number of attendants for a long time. We should avoid killing if we wish to be assured of union with our beloved, our attendants, and our property in a future life. Other karmic fruits of non-killing are courage, frankness, fearlessness, and invulnerability. Thus, in the commentary, we have 23 karmic advantages of non-killing. It is easy to see the evil karmic fruits of killing, for they are just the opposites of the benefits that have been mentioned. Thus, they are ugliness, short span of life, illness, and so forth.